Hi, everyone, and welcome to ABCs of Anesthesia. Now, today, we have a very special guest, Christine Ball, or Adjunct Associate Professor Christine Ball. Now, Christine, just for a brief introduction, she's an anesthesiologist at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne and also co-convener of the Master of Perioperative Medicine at Monash University. Chris has been involved in the study of history of the specialty for over 30 years and has many publications on the subject, including the book, I think this was released just recently, 2021, The Chloroformist. She's been honorary curator at the Jeffrey K. Museum of Anesthetic History since 1989, a position she still holds, and she's a fellow of the Royal Historical Society and the current Wood Library Museum Laureate of the History of Anesthesiology. So it's really great to have such a distinguished guest. Chris, thanks so much for coming on. But more importantly, when I was training at the Alfred, you were just one of my favorite consultants. It was just such a pleasure to work with you. I just always felt so relaxed. And I feel like we always got to try new things out. And that was my experience of working with you. And it was just a great experience because I try to be that person for my trainees and go, hey, what do you want to do today?
That's really nice of you. Also really funny because that is just something I keep doing. I was just talking to one of the registrars the other day about how if you're not keeping learning, you shouldn't keep working.
Yeah. Growing makes me happy. But it's, now I've been a consultant for 10 years. I just work by myself. So I don't, unless the trainees tell me something new or want to try something or see it at a conference, I don't really get the chance to see something or try something unless they're, and literally just the other day, someone was like, oh, let's intubate, with an entry catheter down an LMA. And I just had thoughts on, I can just pass the tube down because I've tried that before. And for some reason, a size 6 tube didn't fit down a size 3 LMA anymore. And it did 10 years ago. So I don't know what's happened. Anyway. So Christine, I thought with the thing that, obviously, history of anesthesia is a massive topic. And this book you've published, The Chloroformist, I think it's just from what I've seen, it's an amazing account of a person who's completely under-recognized. So there's a whole bunch of things to talk about in the space, but I thought from often our audience is a lot of junior doctors and people who are, starting out in anesthesia. And I thought it'd be really good to give an insight about what we did before we had this amazing array of things. And I thought we'd kind of go through just a lot of the common instruments, technologies we have, medications, and just your insights on what it would have been like without that. Well, what was anesthesia like without that?
Firstly, I think it's really important to know that a lot of the technology we take for granted now is very recent, like within my career. So, even when I started anesthetics in the early 1980s, we had very little monitoring. And even I can't remember how different that was. But, we would fight over an automatic blood pressure cuff machine. We would fight over pulse meters. We didn't have pulse oximeters, end-tidal CO2. None of that stuff was available in the 1980s.
Wow.
So the technology that's available now is very new when anesthetics is like nearly 180 years old now.
Hey, so maybe let's say, do you have much recollection of just a general anesthetic, like a lap collie, a relaxing general anesthetic when you were training? And yeah. I mean, maybe you could step me through from IV cannulation to extubation, what that was
okay.
Like.
So to start with that, there were no lap collies when I started. So there was no lap collie surgery. So that was a whole interesting thing, watching the surgeons re-skill in laparoscopic surgery, because although there was laparoscopic gynae surgery, lap collies came in later, and it was really a challenge for the surgeons because the older surgeons had to relearn. And as we were mentioning before we started, they were concerned that if the new surgeons learned to do laparoscopic cholecystectomies, they wouldn't be able to do open ones, which has sort of come to fruition, really.
But, it's kind of true.
Yeah. So a cholecystectomy in the 1980s was an open cholecystectomy. It was a great big wound under the ribs. Mm-hmm. And the anesthetic machine was a bit like the one we've got now, but not electronic. So all the actual substance of the machine hasn't changed. You've still got flow meters, gases flowing over vapors, but the flow meters were visual and manual, so you could actually see the bobbins going up and down. The vaporizer was clipped onto the machine, so you could change them like you can now, but you just clip them onto the back bar. And you could actually take the machine apart. If it didn't work first thing in the morning, you'd you'd start taking it apart with screwdrivers and things.
Was it often leaks in those?
Yeah, machines? Leaks. And so we all got used to actually managing all that ourselves. Obviously, we had people that could come and fiddle with it if we needed to. But even there wasn't even we had these oxygen alarms that were just red lights on the back of the machine to tell us if there was oxygen failure. And we used a lot of nitrous oxide then. So all anesthetics were induced really with thiopentone then. That was our major induction agent. And we'd pre-oxygenate like we do now. We didn't have oximetry. We didn't have end-tidal CO2. We might just have a manual blood pressure cuff. So
you would just pre-oxygenate with the face mask, and you just know that because the bag was going up and down for 5 minutes.
Yes.
Was that your pre-oxygenation?
That was pre-oxygenation. And you'd look at the colour of the patient. So we were very dependent on the fingers because obviously the face mask was covering the face and they weren't see-through then too. They were black face masks.
Yeah, that's right.
And all the circuitry was black and all reused and cleaned. So and the tubes were reusable as well. So the endotracheal tubes were red rubber tubes that had often been cut, but people would cut them to fit the patient rather than having a whole great floppy bit sticking out. So you'd have to go and make sure you have one that was long enough for your patient. And you'd also, when you were checking the machine, you'd look down the endotracheal tube to see if there was anything in it. Because when they were re-cleaned, things would get stuck in the tubes. So sometimes if you couldn't intubate, it was because there was a bit of an old glass ampoule or something stuck in the tube. So I used to put an introducer down all the tubes just to check they were patent before you put them in. The laryngoscopes, obviously we had no video laryngoscopes. We just had Macintosh blades, no rechargeable batteries. So you had to check. You had spare batteries around. So, yeah, you put them off to sleep with thiopentone.
And IV cannulation, same.
IV cannulation. So we were just getting, like, really simple intravenous cannulas, like the Gelcos.
Yeah, but they were plastic-based.
They were plastic then, but they were fairly new. So often for small cases, we just use butterfly needles, which there's still butterflies around, right? But we wouldn't put drips in for little cases. We'd just stick a butterfly needle in the back of the hand. And often they'd cut out because it was just metal in the vein. So you'd often have to replace them. And a lot of people would induce with just a butterfly needle and then put the drip in afterwards. Mm. But for a cholecystectomy, I would have put a drip in. Mm. And then we'd induce with thiopentone. And the muscle relaxants we had then, I'm trying to think what the most, we used a lot of alkuronium from what I can remember, which is not available anymore. We used pancuronium in the cardiac theatres because it was tachycardia inducing. It kept blood pressure up. And then you'd intubate and you'd just rely on chest movement and a stethoscope to make sure that you were in the lungs. And then ventilate by hand. With nitrous oxide, oxygen and usually halothane at that stage. We got Enflurane shortly after I started, but it was expensive.
And just to be clear, so now your tube's in, you've auscultated the lungs. By the way, this is one of my things that I just really want every trainee to do is, like, I rarely see someone with a stethoscope around their neck anymore. So people are tubing and not listening and not checking for lung sounds afterwards and that they haven't done an esophageal intubation. And it's just one of those things I'm really glad I feel like it's just been a thing that's such a low tech but highly efficacious method of finding, the first signs of bronchospasm. Anyway, when you are there, it does that mean you have a precordial stethoscope constantly in your ears?
So we use them for pediatrics, but I don't think I ever used one really in an adult. You would just stay next to the patient. So that was the advantage, I think, of hand ventilating. Like, there were ventilators, but usually only a couple in the whole theatre block, and they tend to be used more for neurosurgery or cardiac where, you really needed to either control the CO2 or needed your hands free. So the ventilators in those theatres, but getting hold of a ventilator was pretty difficult.
But even literally, for how long? 1 to 2 hours You are.
However long you're squeezing the bag.
Yep.
But the thing about squeezing a bag is you can't leave, right? So you're stuck right next to the patient. So, you know, you take the blood pressure manually, and often to do that you would put the bag between your knees to squeeze it, you know, so that you could palpate the pulse. So we'd set everything up so that we had access to feel the pulse, to take the blood pressure. We had ECGs. We put ECGs on people, but not all the time. Short cases often wouldn't put an ECG on because we weren't that excited about monitoring, really.
Yeah. And I mean, how often are you feeling the pulse? How often are you taking your blood pressure?
I guess 5 minutely, because we had manual charts that we filled in and they had 5 minutely spots, right? But, you know, obviously on induction, we weren't measuring the blood pressure anything like as rapidly as we do now, because busy putting the tube in and securing everything, no one's taking the blood pressure. But the other thing I was reflecting on is that we didn't have so much trouble with low blood pressure then, because firstly, the antihypertensive people took were terrible. So the people's blood pressure wasn't very well controlled, and it was very common for people to come to theatre with high blood pressure. And also we used a lot of nitrous oxide and very little volatile. But we didn't have that same big drop in blood pressure that you see today. So we used very little in the way of vasopressors. Then I used a lot of beta blockers and drugs to drop the blood pressure in my first 10 years of my career. It was much more common.
I'm just trying to think. This is almost like every one of your inductions was a cardiac induction. You know, it was low, you know, low hypnotic, not getting a blood pressure drop, managing hypertension.
Yeah.
So there's no running metaraminol. Did you even have metaraminol?
We did have metaraminol, but, you know, certainly would never have drawn it up or used it very often. And so maybe a cholecystectomy is not the best example, because interesting is that, like, breast lumps or like a small plastics cases, even if they were going for an hour, we wouldn't tube them. And we didn't have laryngeal masks, so we just hold a mask on. So we all got very, very good at jaw support. And it was really a modified gas induction. We'd give a little bit of thiopentone so that they'd start to get sleepy, and then we put the mask on, and then we would turn on the nitrous and the oxygen and then gradually put the halothane up. Because if you put it up too fast, they get laryngospasm.
Yeah, right.
So effectively, we did gas inductions, assisted gas inductions for all spont bent anesthetics. So they always kept breathing. And then you would just hold the mask on for all, and the surgeons would just work around your hands. And if they were really lengthy, sometimes we'd use the harness. You know how there's those clips now, and that we'd clip a harness under the head and clip the mask on and make all these props with various bits of equipment to hold the chin up just so we could write the notes, you know.
I've actually done that myself. You know, when you've got a trainee and you say, hey, just hold the mask for the case, get them really good at bag masking for a short period of time. But then if they go for a break, then I'm like, I'm just going to tape on the mask, put a little roll under the chin.
That's what we did for everything. And then, you know, when we got laryngeal masks, it just seemed like, such a difference. But as I said, the whole thing was that we were never far from the patient. You just couldn't walk around the room. You had to be there. You were either holding on the mask or you were doing the actual monitoring manually. So although we didn't have all these electronic monitors, we were stuck to the bed, basically.
Yep.
You know, we couldn't wander around, and therefore we were much more involved in what the surgeons were doing, because they had to work more around us. So it was very different to what it is now. Like, it's pretty remote now, what we do.
Yeah, like you kind of sit back, you organize your monitoring and your view of everything in one scope, and then you can literally just set your alarms and sit back and you know, go into an autopilot. But it sounds like you absolutely couldn't do that then.
Absolutely couldn't. I mean, you know, obviously cardiac neuro, where we'd set it all up, but it would take ages to set up. Because we didn't have one integrated monitor either. So each monitor was separate. So the ECG was one box, and blood pressure, once we got automated blood pressure cuffs in every theatre, they were like a dynamite machine. Everything just sat on top of each other.
Yeah. Did you have invasive arterial monitoring even at that stage?
We did, but I know there were times when we wanted to put art lines in and we didn't have transducers. I can remember a guy teaching me how to put an outline in and then attach it to a line with a bubble in it and stick it on a ruler.
Yeah,
the bubble going back and forth on the ruler, like you'd mark.
I was just thinking you could just have a column of a column reaching up into the air.
Yeah,
you know, whatever pressure, and that would tell you your diastolic and your systolic.
Well, we do that for the CVP, but the blood pressure, the transducers were quite big, and you'd have to make them up yourself. So the little disposable ones we've got now, they didn't have them. So we used to, you'd start the case putting the fluid in your transducer, and it would get damped or whatever. There was big bubbles of air in it, so you had to really, all the stuff that you learned for the first part was much more relevant then, because you had to actually make your own transducers up, and you had to actually, understand the physiology much more when you were doing effectively gas inductions.
Yeah, it's interesting having this conversation about, we learn about the Clark electrode and everything. I'm like, I feel like this was for another time.
It was for another time. And I think there's probably more important things to learn now. Like all the electrical safety too was much more important back in the days when they had flammable anesthetics, because when they used ether regularly, the theatre was full of ether, and it sinks. It sinks to the floor, and then static electricity would set fire to the floor. So there'd be sheets of flames going across the operating
room. That sounds ridiculous. Now, you're in theatre, there's ether on the floor, someone starts like, how many times did you have a floor of fire?
Yeah, so it never happened to me, but it was apparently quite common. So ether was a problem in that regard, and that's why there was a lot of effort to get rid of static electricity in the operating theatres in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. In terms of pain management, so is this morphine intravenously? What are we using?
Morphine or pethidine. We used heaps of pethidine in the 80s. It was very popular, and especially for things like cholecystectomies, because we still believe that morphine would give you spasm of your sphincter of Oddi and all that sort of stuff. So we used pethidine a lot. We had morphine, we had Omnipom, and it was very common to give pre-meds. So we'd often give pre-meds of Omnipom and scopolamine, which was a throwback to the ether days too, because ether makes you salivate.
Mm-hmm.
So they would give scopolamine or morphine and atropine, Omnipom and scopolamine, very commonly as a pre-med to stop the salivation and to relax the patient. And, of course, patients were still coming in the night before. So we would come in and do rounds the night before. Even on a Sunday night, we'd come in for the Monday list, see all the patients, write up the pre-meds, and the first pre-med would be written up to be given at, 7 o'clock. And then after that, we'd ring the ward for the pre-meds. So pre-meds were very common. Of course, they're not used now.
And it reminds me when I first started training, I would read these textbooks and they'd talk about what you're saying. And then to come into theatre and go, hold on, this is nothing like the textbooks. And, to realise that it was a pretty old textbook.
But as I said, I've been practising. I started anaesthetics 1984. So almost 40 years, and everything's changed. So the only things that haven't really are, we still use nitrous oxide a bit, but, pretty much everything is different.
Everything. Like when I started was when, I guess, propofol was the popular agent, but there's still thiopentin. We were still using it as a bit of a, hey, you better see how this works for your part one. To now, it's just not, it's barely in the trolley. And
that's right.
How about antiemesis? Like, I imagine the rates were high, and
they were. It was quite problematic, and we only had Maxillon Stematil really. So I think that was a really big. It was a huge problem with ether because ether causes a lot of nausea and vomiting. Halothane was better. They all sort of got better. Enflurane, which I used a lot of. Was supposed to be better, but it wasn't really. And it gave me the most terrible headache. So the scavenging wasn't very good, of course, when we were using, we were just holding masks on people. So often I would stop using etherane because by the end of the day I would have such a bad headache.
That's I think that's part of the reason why I didn't really enjoy pediatric anesthesia. I just had a headache from sevoflurane.
Interesting.
Hey, so it sounds like these patients, we're just not seeing the same, you're not seeing the same kind of pattern of things that we would experience day to day now. You know, you get a patient, what's the age range that you're getting? You know, often most of my patients are above 100 kilo. A massive fraction of my patients are now, I don't even blink at 100 kilo patient. That's just the norm. If they're 150, I start taking notice. They're often into their 70s and 80s. Was it a very different population then?
Yeah, it definitely was. We didn't see a lot of obesity 40 years ago. And we didn't see a lot of these really sick patients, because I think there was a lot more decisions made about inappropriate medicine. You know, we didn't have things to offer them.
Yeah.
In the vascular theatres, we do a lot of fempops and all that sort of stuff. But it was, even with the trauma cases, it was not common to keep going for very long. We didn't have the blood bank resources. Mm. So it was very common to have deaths on the table in the 1980s because blood, we didn't even have, at the Alfred, we didn't have a lot of blood on site. So when a major trauma came in, and the Alfred was trauma centre even then, we would ring up South Melbourne Blood Bank and tell them that we had a trauma coming, we were going to need 6 units of packed cells, 6 units of FFP, 6 units of platelets and everything, and they'd say, okay, they'd send that down, but we only had a certain amount actually on site. Mm. And then if you wanted to keep going, you had to ring South Melbourne and you had to give them all the obs and the patient's age and everything. And sometimes they'd say, well, we haven't got any more blood. You can't have it.
Wow.
Sometimes they'd send it. So, you know, I can remember nights where young people died on the operating table for want of resuscitation.
And that's changed completely. I mean, I remember my experience at the Alfred is we have, it feels unlimited. I remember giving up to 30, 40 units to someone. And that's, I don't think that's that uncommon, is it?
No, but it definitely was then. And ICU is different too. So there's no way they would take someone to ICU if that patient was going to die. I mean, now it's pretty common if we say, look, this patient's not going to make it, but we'll take them down to ICU. They're better at dealing with those end-of-life conversations. They're set up for it. They're happy to do it. But they wouldn't have taken those patients then. So we had far more conversations with relatives and patients about that sort of thing, because theatre was where people died.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that seems remarkable, because I, except for the ones that we're never going to make it, I've only seen a few deaths on the table, and that's, it's just so unexpected. And even then, you can often get someone alive enough that you transport to ICU these days.
Sure.
How about emergencies? I mean, back then, you're obviously not taking as many, blood pressure recordings, but, you know, severe bronchospasm, laryngospasm, say the deadly ones, maybe severe bronchospasm, anaphylaxis, even MH. What's the experience of that?
So anaphylaxis back then, I think, you know, it was very much a clinical pattern you'd have to recognise. You know, you didn't have oximetry, but they become cyanos. So, I imagine we treated things at a much lower oxygen than we would now, because you're looking for cyanosis, so that's coming later than you would see with oximetry. But on the other hand, you didn't panic because you haven't got all those numbers and alarms going off. You just you can't ventilate and they're going blue, so you do something about it. I mean, the treatment of anaphylaxis hasn't really changed a lot in that time. It's just adrenaline, and so that's what we would do. MH is a really interesting one, because the history of MH, I don't know how many of your listeners will know, but it's a very recent and Melbourne-based story. So malignant hypothermia was probably recognised as a condition related to anaesthesia in the 1960s. So prior to that, there'd been talk about ether fevers, there'd been talk about heat stroke, there'd been people dying under anaesthesia known to have high temperatures, but they didn't know. Was it sepsis? Was it the ether? Was it something else? And then there was a guy who presented to the Royal Melbourne Hospital 1961 with a broken leg. He'd actually broken his leg just outside the hospital. He'd had 9 relatives die under anaesthesia, and he told the anaesthetist that. So the anaesthetist said, well, look, he rang around, found out as much as he could, and said, look, they all had ether probably. We've just got halothane now, so it'll probably be all right. And they took him to theatre. They induced him with thiopentone, nitrous oxide, halothane, and within 5 minutes his blood pressure started to drop, his heart rate started to go up. And Jim Villiers, who is the anaesthetist, who's still alive, he turned 100 the other day. He decided that the same thing was happening. He didn't want this patient to die, so he told the surgeon the operation couldn't proceed, to just do a GAMP on this fracture. So that's what they did. They woke him up. He was incredibly hot and had very low blood pressure. So Jim gave him some whole blood, cold whole blood, which was helpful because he thought he might be bleeding. And then because he was so hot, he just packed him in ice because they had a lot of ice in the cardiac theatres back then. Mm-hmm. So he survived and was the first person to survive a known episode of malignant hypothermia. And then Jim actually went to the physicians and said, this thing's happened. This guy's got a genetic condition. Is anybody interested in following it up? Mm. And Michael Denbrough was working as a PhD student in the Royal Melbourne then, and he went and followed it up and traced the whole family history and started the whole discussion about malignant hypothermia from that original patient.
Who was the anaesthetist you mentioned?
James Villiers, his name is.
I'll say that again.
James Villiers, Villiers.
Right. Because I've heard of, Michael Denbrough, but not Jim.
No, so not Jim, yeah, because he's a very humble man and he never made a big song and dance about it. But his name's on, so Michael Denbrough and Richard Lovell are on the first paper about MH. Mm. And then a year later, the same patient had a spinal anaesthetic, which was successful. And then Jim's name is on that paper with all the other researchers.
Yeah, okay. It's a really great, I mean, many, many anaesthetists potentially saw the same style of history.
Yes.
And this is the anaesthetist that went, you know what, I'm going to do this, treat it symptomatically, yep, and catch on to the fact that there's something wrong here.
Yes. And the other thing was that he and Kingsley Mills, the surgeon, worked together their whole careers. And Kingsley Mills said to me, it was because he trusted Jim so much. When Jim said, we've got to stop, like he can't do this operation, he said, okay, fine, let's get out. And that symbiotic relationship between surgeon and anaesthetist in a crisis like that, you know, it made such a difference. And then the follow-up with the physicians was inspiration. I mean, he could have just walked away from it, but he didn't. Yeah. Then, of course, the other interesting thing about MH is that they had no way of treating it other than to treat it with cold. And over the next sort of 10, 15 years, they developed packs for treating MH, which had cold packs in it. They had drugs like chlorpromazine, which caused vasodilation and loss of heat. They established an animal model in pigs and then started using some local anaesthetics because they seemed to help the arrhythmias. So I think that there was a pact described in the 1970s for the treatment of MH that every hospital should have. I think it's one of the first examples of an actual like crisis kit in an operating theatre. And then dantrolene wasn't until the 1980s. So we'd only just got dantrolene when I started.
I think I saw the stats that it changed the mortality from 50% or 80% to 5%.
Even better now. And the diagnosis is much better now, of course.
Okay. And even dantrolene, wasn't it? It was accidentally discovered. This is meant to be a muscle relaxant. It's just not very useful for that. Not very effective for that.
Often those things happen. You rediscover drugs that have been tried for something else.
And now I remember a story about, a bit of a side note, that people were doing intrathecal catheters, intentional intrathecal catheters, microcatheters, which are extremely useful, but because they were using a specific solution, it went out of favor. Do you have any recollection of this, that potentially intrathecal microcatheters should potentially still a useful thing with the right solution?
Well, what I do know is that spinals were very common. I mean, we used quite a few epidurals, but in the past, the spinal started, in the 1800s, and they used a lot of heavy solutions. because they could get it down low. But, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, they did some extraordinary operations on the spinal, you know, really high, intentionally high spinals. Mm. So there was a real vogue for that. And then there was a bit of a crisis in, I can't actually tell you the date, so it was around the 1950s, where there were two patients developed long-standing paralysis after spinal anaesthetics. And that was due to the alcohol solution that the local anaesthetics were being sterilized in. There were cracks in the glass sample. And so spinals, you know, they were really worried about neurotoxicity. And then there was also a problem with a drug called, I think it was 2-chloroprocaine. One of the procaine local anaesthetics caused neurotoxicity. So maybe that's what you're referring to. But there were catheters put in very early on for like top-up spinals. People did extraordinary things with spinals, but patients got terrible, terrible headaches. So we only got those really small spinal needles really in about the 1990s. Mm. Prior to that, you know, I would do something like a TURP with like a 22 or even a 20-gauge spinal needle.
Yeah, everyone. Post-dual puncture headaches for everyone.
Oh. Well, so I guess a lot of them were elderly, so they wouldn't get them because, like, the TURPs we had to do under spinal because of the solutions that the surgeons were using. It was very common to get TURP syndrome. So we wanted the patients wide awake. We wouldn't give them any sedation at all.
Yep.
And we'd time the surgery.
Yeah.
Stop. But.
Yeah, with the whole lips now, it's just changed completely. Just,
Yeah.
I haven't done a spinal TURP in a long time just because of the speed.
So, and the other thing is we would never do spinals for seizures for that reason too because we didn't have small spinal needles. So we did all our local anesthetic seizures under epidural, which was, you know, you would have to coax them through it. It was never perfect.
Yeah.
And the surgeons would help. They would often, you know, put a bit of local in or whatever, but spinals for seizures are revolutionary. I think, you know, now we've got those really fine needles. It's a completely different thing.
Yeah. I remember I was in Bendigo and one of the technicians there and the techs there, you know, they really very good at the anesthetic side of things and almost all of them can pretty much give an anesthetic up, especially the older ones. And he's telling me that, yeah, they did intentional total spinals, massive volume into the intrathecal space, followed by 1 to 2 milligrams of adrenaline, and that was the way it was done.
Yeah, I think people were quite courageous, but you know, if you've got no monitoring, you don't know what's actually going wrong, do you? And patients were probably more accepting too of it not being perfect. You know, if you go right back to the beginning of anaesthesia in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, when we just had ether and chloroform, open masks. Because when we look back on it now, it sounds insane, but they weren't really fully anaesthetized the way we are now. So they would often get people really deep, start the surgery, take the mask off, let the patient wake up a bit. So if they were doing like dental surgery or whatever, the patient would wake up, spit out the blood, you know, whatever, and then they'd put them back to sleep again. So the surgeons were used to a different sort of anaesthetic.
Yep.
The patients weren't expecting to be asleep for the whole operation. They would just be like, you know, keep me asleep for the painful bits and I'll wake up and cough and, you know, clear my own airway because there was no other way of doing it.
Yeah, I remember for the first 5 years of doing eye blocks for cataracts, everyone was completely awake and now everyone has some level of sedation. That's just what they expect and we feel like they should have as well. But it sounds like you're doing asleep, awake, asleep techniques for.
Yeah, well, they certainly were because there was no, like when anaesthesia was invented, don't forget, everyone was used to having no anaesthesia. So so any sort of anaesthetic was going to be better than that. Yeah. So, and surgeons were used to operating without anaesthetic. So I think when you look back at the origins of thoracic surgery and neurosurgery and everything, there was no expectation really that the anaesthetist could improve the operating conditions. You know, they were just grateful for any help they could get. So the surgeons were not going to complain about the brain bulging out of the craniotomy wound because it didn't enter their heads that the anaesthetist could help in any way.
Yeah, okay. Chris, from everything you've kind of worked with and seen come and go, I guess, is there anything that you would bring back that doesn't exist now?
Well, my only concern, I guess, is our distance from the patients. I mean, I think monitoring is fantastic, and I would hate to give an anaesthetic now without modern monitors. But by the same token, we're more distracted now. You know, we've got so many monitors. We're so used to it all just working. We're so distracted by other things in the room and our phones. And there's an expectation now that you can multitask, that you'll be able to get onto the electronic record and write the drugs up for the patient who's in recovery while you're giving an anaesthetic. You know, that's where errors start to happen, you know, because you've got too many anaesthetic records open or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think that's my biggest concern. I think my generation of anaesthetists will still be more closely monitoring the actual patient because that's what we grew up with. But you know, I see now people induce the patient, stick in the laryngeal mask, turn on the ventilator and walk over to the other side of the room and start talking to someone. And you think, I haven't even started the surgery yet. You know, I feel like you need to be standing there when they start the surgery because something might go wrong. You know, so it's that lack of attachment to the patient that bothers me most.
And that makes a lot of sense. I think we're definitely all guilty of this, the distance that now comes from having monitoring. But like, I also realize that there's a lot of things I think we develop over time. Like as soon as the surgeon says something, you know, starting, everything stops. But if you're a junior, you don't necessarily realize that everything will stop at that time. Or just the ability to hear the sounds, you know, the surgeon talks a bit faster, sounds a bit more stressed, the suction's working louder, the tone, the tempo, all these other indicators. Yeah, again, I think really useful for having that connection with the patient. No, that makes a lot of sense. There's a pattern that I've noticed is that, so when I was starting, it was always, direct laryngoscopy and then the video laryngoscopy, the CMAX and the grass came in. And then there was this kind of training period. And then people were trying to figure out, oh, look, if we do that all the time, then we'll lose the skills of having the original video device. And then I think the same thing had already happened with ultrasounds and regional anesthesia. I can do any kind of regional block, but not nerve stimulation blocks. If there is an ultrasound, which occasionally there isn't, I don't have that skill set anymore. It's gone from my hands.
That really doesn't bother me. I think we have to embrace some of that new technology. You know, I wouldn't put a central line in now without an ultrasound because it's not as safe, right?
Yep.
You know, we put them in for years without them and sure it worked, but things went wrong. And, you know, equally, I intubated a lot of really sick trauma patients with swollen faces with blind nasal intubations. Now, I was good at them, but I wouldn't do that anymore. And I don't think it's a technique. We can't teach that technique anymore because we have better ways of doing it. And sure, you might find yourself in an emergency where you don't have a fiber optic scope or something and you've got to improvise. But I don't think we can put other patients at risk in order to learn those skills that are, in fact, you know, dangerous for patients. So it's the same with local anesthetic blocks. You know, we've got ultrasound now. We should learn how to use it. And if it's not available, well, why is it not available? You know, is this block an emergency? And so then do you have a crack? I mean, I think that's the way you've got to think. You can't just teach people things without safe equipment, just in case. And I'm not a great subscriber to this thing that we've got to teach people to use old laryngoscopes either. You can teach direct laryngoscopy with a video laryngoscope if you use the right ones. Yes. You can teach people to do direct laryngoscopy. So I think, you know, you can use the tools even better. So I will often use something like a CMAC to teach people to intubate. Well, I'll have the screen and get them to do it directly so I can see.
I do exactly the same. So would you say that now every time you intubate, at least with the trainees, you always have the video laryngoscope?
No, I don't. I don't. But because we don't have enough. But I think the time will come. Yeah. And I think they're better. And certainly, you know, you get those odd patients. Like actually, I had one the other day where they've added on the list and you haven't really, you look at them across the room and think, oh, they'll be fine. And then you go to intubate and think, oh, I totally missed the fact that this patient's larynx is not where it should be, you know. And then I have to get the video laryngoscope and it's all fine. Everything's fine. But, you know, if I'd started with a video laryngoscope,
would
have been fine. And so, you know, I know there's a school of thought among especially my generation that we should be using direct laryngoscopy first. But if everybody switched to video laryngoscopes tomorrow, I wouldn't care. And I, you know, I think
that point.
The same argument you could make about normal laryngoscopes. They used to fail. We didn't have batteries. We didn't have globes. You know, you can talk about it forever. You know, there was an argument, well, why are we intubating people when you can hold on a mask? Well, you know, we can't go back to it's safer, right? So do what's safer.
I just love that progressive stance, Chris. And I completely agree. I think there was a point when I was thinking, oh, the technique here isn't as good because you're too used to the video laryngoscope. But that's just a problem with teaching. Still use the video laryngoscope. Just turn the screen away. Just make sure that's a teaching tool and you don't have to re-look. And if it's genuinely hard, you just turn the screen and go, hey, there it is. Put it in.
Yeah. And it's the same, I think, with ventilators and teaching physiology now. Like I don't like it if people put the laryngeal mask in and just stick the ventilator on, because I think it's such a unsafe time at that point, you know, because between the intravenous induction and the gases starting to work, then the patient's not got a secure, stable anesthetic. So I would rather stay close to the patient at that time. But I still think there's a place for people using assisted ventilation with laryngeal masks. It's just got to be used for the right reasons.
And how do you do this? So you put the LME in and then you just gently bag, let the CO2
I hold the bag because I think for me that anchors me to the patient until the surgeon started. I like to be stuck to the patient somehow in the first 10 minutes, you know, because it's so easy to get distracted. Yeah. I just like, and having a bag in your hand, like you get not just the ventilation, but you can feel the pulse actually.
You can feel it. And that's why the PSV Pro often triggers it, because you can feel that movement. I do a very similar thing. I want them to spot vents. So I don't want to ventilate them too hard, but I just have my hand on the bag while I used to be writing notes or on the EMR with the other hand. Mm. And then as soon as I feel them breathing, I'm like, yeah, good. I can let this go now and see how they do.
Somebody taught you that, though.
I made that up myself, Chris.
And I think, like, you know, PSV Pro is great for the high CO2, right? You know, then you can put that on to keep the CO2 down once everything's stable. But, you know, we shouldn't forget, I think, that induction is not the end of it's not stable anesthesia. Induction lasts a while, and then you've got to get to a point where you've got equilibrium and then everything's fine, you know. But during that time when the surgeon's starting all the initial stimulation, putting the drapes on, a lot can go wrong in that time. You need to be really focused, I think.
And Chris, what do you think, where do you think anesthesia technology should be moving towards? Like, if you had all the resources and time and money, where would you be putting your funding towards?
I find that a terrifying conversation to have, because, you know, honestly, if you told me, you know, 40 years ago, if you'd asked me what I'd wanted, it would be a pulse oximeter and total CO2. Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
That's going to mess up your recording.
No, not at all.
So, you know, I think the things that I wanted in my career were end-tidal CO2, oximetry, and things like that we have now. So to imagine the future, I guess it would be lovely to have something. I'm a bit of a Star Trek fan, you know. It would be lovely to be able to just go up and do what they do on Star Trek and stick something on someone's neck and they're just asleep and unconscious and they've got no monitoring. They've got, you know, like no drips, no pain, because that would be lovely to be able to induce people without the stress, without the pain.
Yeah. You know,
but obviously that's very futuristic.
And to be honest, like, if we had the perfect, like, our drugs are extremely blunt instruments. They do this very well, hypnosis, but then they just do everything else bad. And that's why we have a job, really.
Yeah, that's right.
You don't need us, which is totally fine.
And I guess, you know, what I would like is to get not so much the anaesthetic, but to be having better conversations as a society about end-of-life care and about futile care, because, you know, I see that more as a problem now. It wasn't a problem 40 years ago. It's a problem now because we can keep everyone alive.
Mm.
And we have far less conversations about futility. We're starting to get to do it again now, but we can keep people alive a lot longer than we used to. And quality of life and that sort of thing needs to be discussed more. Yeah. I think.
And it's hard because I definitely have felt since starting training that discussion has happened and everyone's talking about it. But at the pointy end of things, when the patient's right there and they were totally fine, independent from home, 90-year-old, and now they are dying, and now it seems futile. That's the bridge that I haven't seen crossed yet.
Yeah, I think we have a long way to go in that, but I do think we are having the conversations now, and the growth in perioperative medicine is facilitating that, you know. And I think the team-based medicine, that's a huge advance too. Like, we're working much better with geriatricians and physicians. There's much more expectation now that it's not one person for the job, that we can all work as a team, I think. So yeah. I'd like to see that develop rather than, you know, I think anaesthesia is now really very safe. We're tinkering around the edges with anaesthetics now, but I think deciding what we should be doing is probably more important right now.
Yeah, okay. I had a feeling maybe you'd say something along the lines of, you know, AI will take over most of the automation of anaesthesia and, you know, well, just...
AI, it's an interesting discussion, AI. I think, once again, we should embrace it rather than and make it work for us rather than stick our heads in the sand. I mean, AI is coming or is here. You know, we can't ignore it and we have to use it to our advantage. It's definitely going to be helpful. You know, we can't ignore something like ChatGPT. It's there now. I teach on the Monash Masters. People are going to use it. They will definitely use ChatGPT to write the beginning of their essay, but maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Yeah.
Maybe that saves you a whole lot of time. So we just have to get smarter about how we use it. What's really important is that we know what it's doing and that we keep up to date. Because if we don't, you know, companies will give us technology rather than us asking for it, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. This is the same pattern that's always happened. You have to embrace it. Otherwise, yeah, sticking your head in the sand, as you say, is just never the answer for it. And I know that I've been giving a few interview talks earlier this year to the kind of the junior group. And I say, hey, you know, I remember at one point I was like, how do you dress for your interview? And I said, look, for men, this is what I'd suggest. I'm not going to even go into what I recommend for women, but I will ask ChatGPT. And it just spit out this amazing answer that, well, I was like, you know, I don't have to touch anything too controversial there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think automated anaesthesia, well, yeah, maybe we'll get to that point. But what's important is that the patient is a person and there will always need to be a person helping them make decisions about their future. So we can automate everything we want. We can have surgeons doing robotic surgery from home if that's, you know, where the future is lying. But there's still a person on the operating table that needs help with their human life. So, you know, I think it's important that we maintain that interface.
I think that's a really good thing to actually say, because I think a lot of what we've talked about is that connection to the patient. And this is really another reflection of that, whether you're in the operating theatre, not to be too detached and have that rapid response back to the patient, especially if the need calls, and in a global sense as well. I think, yeah, it's really good to reiterate. Hey Chris, just as we're coming up to around the time where I think we've covered most of the things we want to cover, I did want to ask you a couple of random things about what we did before your time when you started training. So, you know, what do we do before we had intravenous cannulas and needles? Like, how were we giving drugs or fluid into the veins? Like,
We weren't, basically. So when anaesthesia started in 1846, there were no intravenous cannulas, there was no intravenous fluid, none of that stuff existed. So a lot of people died for want of fluid. You know, the cholera epidemics of the 1860s and 1880s, people died from lack of fluid, but they started thinking about it. There were people tried giving intravenous solutions, so they would cut into veins and stick just a metal pipe in, basically, and then put in boiled water and salt. And there were certainly people who survived that, but it was so cumbersome and the statistics were so Well, the evidence wasn't enough, you know, to make it worthwhile. And it was the same with blood. Like, the original blood transfusions were direct patient to patient around about 1900. Mm-hmm. There were people that started resuscitating people by getting like their twin brother or whatever on the table next to them and stick a cannula from one arm to the other.
Yeah.
And just get the blood going downhill or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then when they started doing blood transfusions, which was around the time of the First World War, they started having the ability to store blood mm-hmm. and to stop it clotting and that sort of thing. They used great big hollow needles that the surgeons cut down onto the veins and then sewed in place.
Oh, the saphenous was cut down, we learn in EMST.
Yeah, so that was what they did. And it wasn't until much later that we started seeing easy to insert cannula. You know, really, it really was the 30s, 40s when they started having, you know, things that anaesthetists could put in, maybe even the 50s, because so patients weren't sitting around the ward with drips in. They were being given fluid and then the thing was all taken away, you know?
Yeah, right.
And so most drugs were given intramuscularly or so, you know, pain relief was given intramuscularly and or orally. The oral work was much more commonly used.
Mm. Thanks, Chris. That was, yeah, really, really interesting discussion. Chris, so if anyone's really interested in this, where can they go for more information? And also, I'd love you to plug your book and tell what the chloroformist is about.
So the book is about the first 30 years of anaesthesia in London, really. It's based around the life of Joseph Clover, who was one of the first full-time anaesthetists. But he's very pivotal in that he also was very close to people like Joseph Lister, who, and without antiseptics, anaesthesia, you know, really wouldn't have made the inroads it did because we couldn't do successful surgery, really, until we had antiseptics. So the two developed together, and early anaesthesia was very dependent on surgeons and anaesthetists working close together. So, and Clover was very responsible for all the early equipment development. He really developed the first calibrated vaporizer for chloroform. It was very crude, but he did it. He also developed the whole technique of putting nitrous oxide over a vapor, which is really the basis of our current anaesthetic machine. So that first 30 years, a lot was established. And he talked a lot about monitoring the pulse, watching the patient. He talked a lot about preparation for theatre, about calming patients down. So there's a lot of really fundamental stuff in that first 30 years, and his life just encompassed all that for me. So that's what the book's about, published by Melbourne University Press, available online and through like good bookshops. They'll get it for you.
Excellent.
But if you want other information, the ASA, Australian ASA, has a timeline on their website, which is 81 pages long.
Oh, wow. Impressive.
So that's a whole big timeline. There's a lot of good books around. I think, yeah, there's one called Ether Day by Julie Fuster, which is just about the very early days of anaesthesia. There are books about early use of muscle relaxants. I can't remember the name of any of them off the top of my head. But the College Library has a whole historical section. Gwen Wilson wrote an amazing book about, it's called One Grand Chain, about the development of anaesthesia in Australia. And that's a wonderful two-volume book where she traces the whole, how the story got out to Australia, newspapers coming on the ship, and then the development of the college and the ASA and everything. So that's available at the college. And then the cover notes, of course, that I write for anaesthesia intensive care.
Yeah, love those.
We've been writing them since 1989. So that's a lot of writing.
Yeah.
They were compiled into a book in 2012, I think, which was available through the ASA. They may still have copies. But all the cover notes we do six a year. They're all now freely available online. They're open access.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the history of all these things we've been talking about is covered in the cover notes because we've done series. We've done a series on intravenous drugs, intravenous equipment, endotracheal tubes, the development of the circle circuit, all of those things. So the cover notes is a really good place to go, anaesthesia intensive care.
Excellent. Oh, thanks, Christine. Yeah, really, really great to chat with you. And so I think we'll probably end it there. Thanks, everyone. Yeah, thanks, everyone, for listening. And yeah, especially thanks, Chris, for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Lon.
So yeah, please share with anyone who might be interested, and we'll see you again next time. This is ABC's of Anesthesia. Thanks a lot.